Hey friends, welcome back to the Journal Feed. My name is Nick Zelt, and this is the only place where I get to spoon feed you the latest in emergency medicine. We've got recent articles appraised and concisely summarized for your benefit. Now, if you are hearing this right now, then you are not currently a Journal Feed subscriber, and so you're not getting the entire Journal Feed podcast, only receiving a portion of the past week's articles. Don't worry, they're all good articles. But if you would like to receive full access to both the podcast and the blog, then you'll have to become a member. All the details for that are at journalfeed.org. And remember, we never want money to be a barrier to better patient care. So if you're having any trouble affording a subscription, just get in touch. We'll help you out. This is the audio version of the past week's summaries, which were brought to you by our authors, Amanda Matthews, Michael Stoker, Megan Hilbert, Dendrick Cooper, Millie Cosse, and Clay Smith. Okay, let's skip straight to the third article. Titled Retrospective Comparison of Upper and Lower Extremity Intraosseous Access During Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest Resuscitation, under the journal Pre-Hospital Emergency Care. I like a good intraosseous line as sure as anybody. I'm sure you do too. They're handy in a pinch. I mean, sure, your labs are probably going to be pretty messed up if you try to send them from that line. But you can treat an IO like a central line, and you can install it in just a couple of seconds. It's not a permanent solution at all, and you should still probably work on getting proper venous access. But once you've got an IO, at least you know you've got a line, and you can pretty much always get an IO. Most of the time, I see IOs placed, well, they go for the easy target on the tibia. But the humeral head is much closer to the heart, and thus central circulation, and thus getting the medications that you give where you want them more quickly. These authors thought to see if the location that you placed your IO could affect rates of ROSC and survival. And guess what? They actually found higher rates of ROSC, an adjusted odds ratio of 1.11, and even survival to discharge, adjusted odds ratio of 1.23, which were higher if the intraosseous line was placed in the upper extremity after multivariable logistic regression. But there's a but, of course there's a but. There's some limitations here, you know. This study looked at where the first successful IO was placed. So we don't know if humeral IOs were done only after other failed IOs or why that location was chosen in any particular patient. Tibial IOs are typically easier to place, though, with patient-specific factors like obesity playing a smaller role in their difficulty. On top of it, humeral IOs, I mean, they kind of have their limitations. They're a lot more likely to become dislodged, something you might not notice at first and then just get medication extravagation, which is time-wasted and it's really not ideal. Also, this was a pre-hospital study, where generally small volumes of medications are being given, and this might not necessarily translate as well to the hospital setting. I very much appreciate how cautious the authors were in the conclusions that they had from this study in their paper, and that they're not calling for ridiculous things like mandating upper extremity intraosseous lines. All that said, I still default to a humeral IO if possible. But the most important thing is probably getting access at all, so I'm generally not that picky as long as something goes in. And typically, the room is a little bit less crowded near the legs, and so it's just easier to work. In a spoonful, in subgroup analysis, there may be more successful ROSC in patients with upper extremity intraosseous access compared with lower extremity access in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. But these results should be adopted with a little bit of caution. And then the fourth article titled Associations Between End-Tidal Carbon Dioxide During Pediatric Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation, CPR Quality and Survival, out of the journal Circulation. How good is your CPR? Now, unless you have a coach, which you probably should during most resuscitations, and ACLS and PALS are really trying to stress this lately, then your best indication of how good your CPR is going, how good your resuscitation is going, might be your end-tidal CO2. A high end-tidal CO2 probably means that you could possibly have ROSC, or your CPR is doing pretty good, and you're more likely to get ROSC as a result. This association between end-tidal CO2 levels and improved outcomes has been shown pretty clearly, but mostly in adults. Pediatric patients arrest for different reasons, often due to respiratory diseases, and perhaps that could affect your end-tidal CO2 levels. It's worth verifying that indeed end-tidal CO2 is an important marker in children, just like we have it in adults. This was a multi-center prospective observational cohort study done across 10 sites in their pediatric ICUs. Altogether, 234 children were analyzed. All children had to have been intubated prior to the arrest with an end-tidal CO2 monitoring in place during the CPR. They compared groups according to the average end-tidal CO2 during the first 10 minutes of CPR. They divided patients into those with levels above 20 millimeters of mercury and those below. As you might expect, being in the high end-tidal CO2 group with levels above 20 was associated with higher rates of sustained ROSC, 71% versus 58%, which is a pretty big difference. Also, there was a 17% higher rate of survival to discharge with this higher end-tidal CO2 group. Rates of favorable neurological outcomes or new morbidities were similar. Now, high end-tidal CO2 was associated with higher systolic and diastolic blood pressures, which is likely the reason that they had higher end-tidal CO2 levels, because they were perfusing everything better. Interestingly, there was no significant difference in CPR quality in terms of the rate of compressions or the depth. So it's hard to tell these PICUs what they need to improve to get better outcomes on those other patients. Now I'm thinking that maybe the higher CO2 levels were more due to patient-specific factors necessarily than the resuscitation itself. Looking at their tables, I don't see a clear difference in patient characteristics that would otherwise explain higher levels of end-tidal CO2 in one group versus the other. I did notice, though, that 40 to 55% of patients were receiving calcium and around 50% of patients were receiving bicarbonate, which seems to be just given empirically in these cases because if you look at the reasons for their arrests, it's not immediately explainable. With higher rates in the low end-tidal CO2 group, presumably because they had CPR for longer periods. Now, like I said, the immediate causes of arrest don't seem to support the use of these agents per se, so just a friendly reminder that just because they're dead doesn't mean you should throw the whole kitchen sink at them, just thoughtlessly. They can indeed become more dead because we haven't lost hope at getting ROSC yet, so use medications when there are actually indications for them. Altogether, higher end-tidal CO2 levels during resuscitation, well, it's good. And if you can get to a number over 20, all the better. If your CO2 levels are low, then look for things to optimize. If you run out of things to optimize, then the outlook might just not be very good. If they remain low, then rates of recovery are lower. In a spoonful, end-tidal CO2 levels above 20 millimeters of mercury during pediatric resuscitations was associated with higher rates of survival in patients with in-hospital cardiac arrests. Okay, that's all the articles we have from this week. Let's do a quick wrap-up. What did we learn today? Then from the third article, many caveats, but if you're able, then perhaps an upper extremity intraosseous line is preferable in terms of ROSC and survival for your patients. From the fourth article, intra-arrest end-tidal CO2 levels above 20 millimeters of mercury are associated with higher rates of ROSC and survival in pediatric in-hospital arrests. Again, if you're hearing this, then you are not a part of the members feed, and so you missed three articles that we reviewed from this past week. What were the articles you missed? Well, one looked at should we be age-adjusting adult vital signs? One looked at pediatric vital signs and which of them are most predictive for life-saving interventions. And then we looked at epinephrine and its role to play in eCPR. Links to all the original articles can be found at journalfeed.org. Just follow the links in the show notes. Our goal here is for you to read less, learn more, and save lives, one spoonful at a time. Thank you.